Case 14-70070, Vincent Forrest et al., appellants v. Imam Faisal Rauf et al. Mr. Klayman for the appellants, Mr. Hogue for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case was brought on behalf of a valiant first responder who's been awarded a medal by former President George W. Bush. He was trapped under the World Trade Tower for hours. He takes 23 medications. He's dying. He's an American hero. And myself. The issues in front of this court deal with the dismissal of the lower court case on the basis of the anti-SLAPP. That's the sole basis upon which the lower court judge, Judge Rothstein, dismissed the case. She stated in her order.
Didn't you have an alternative ground of that it was time barred?
Not the way she wrote the order, Your Honor. It does not, in fact, say she's dismissing it under the statute of limitations, although she does discuss that. She says at the end of her order, accordingly, defendant's special motion to dismiss, pursuant to the Anti-SLAPP Act, is granted and plaintiff's complaint is dismissed. So she was dismissing it based on this high standard of a likelihood of success on the merits, which this court has already ruled does not apply to this court in diversity cases. That was the Abbas case, which I'm sure you're familiar with, because Rule 56 and Rule 12 has a simple pleading standard which would allow a plaintiff to go to trial.
We have to deal with some jurisdictional questions first.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's start with diversity. We've gotten a flurry of papers late last night and this morning on that.
Correct. Your Honor asked that question, so I filed a motion to amend the record. I thought I might speed things along this morning. I could have answered it, too.
You might have speeded things along better if you'd done it at the district court where the issue was originally raised.
Well, Your Honor, we didn't feel we had to do that because the complaint does show diversity here. The caption of the complaint shows that Mr. Forrest has a Connecticut address.
Address is not the state of citizenship. It's not the same as citizenship.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. I'm not disputing that. So we did clear it up. You asked the question.
You said at all relevant times, but you didn't define all relevant times. Can you tell us what your citizenship and Mr. Forrest's citizenship were at the time the complaint was filed?
I've been a citizen of Florida since early in the 1990s. I ran for the U.S. Senate there as a Republican candidate.
Okay, so
I'm a citizen and a domiciliary.
At the time the complaint was filed.
Correct. About that?
Okay, and Mr. Forrest, at the time the complaint was filed, was a citizen of which state?
Connecticut.
And how is that to be reconciled with what you filed in your opposition to the motion to dismiss in district court, where you said the Supreme Court of New York found that Forrest does not have a bona fide residence? He was located in New York as well as Connecticut at the time of the complaint.
Because he spent time, what we're trying to say is he spent time in that area, in the zone of 9/11. He had an office there, and he would sleep there, and he would stay there. So we're not saying that he's a citizen of New York, but we're saying he did spend time in that area. And, of course, we didn't sue on the basis of attacking Islam. That's how this case arose.
Again, I want to keep focused here on his citizenship. Because you seem to be using residence as if you just said that your complaint was using residence as a substitute for citizenship because that's all you listed in the caption.
No, what we're saying here is, Your Honor, is that we did show that there was diversity. We did plead diversity under Section 1331.
You did not plead diversity. You've just said you were at all relevant times a domiciliary of Florida, and that does not appear in the complaint anywhere.
Well, we did plead. What I'm saying is we pled the statute, 1331.
You didn't. You mentioned the statute.
Yes, we mentioned the statute.
But you mentioned foreign.
And the caption. Let me explain something here, if I may.
You mentioned foreign diversity in the complaint.
We are sensitive about the addresses because of the fact that we were threatened by the defendants in this case to say that, in effect, you're an enemy of Islam. I can read you what they said. And it wasn't just published in New York Post. This was, as alleged, published to the radical Muslim world.
I don't think we need a reading of that. I think we know people
in all kinds of
cases. All kinds of cases. Well, there's ways to deal with that in district court, which you didn't do. Right? If you've got a security issue, ask to file it under seal.
Your Honor, I'm sorry that that this issue arose in terms of the security, but it is an issue in terms of this case. Mm-hmm. And consequently, I used what was my office address here. I knew that we had diversity. I was not a citizen of New York. nor was Mr. Flores. We were citizens of different states. Okay. And we did plead that here by claiming 1331 is diversity of citizenship. We could have used greater specificity. I agree. I'm not arguing with you. But we've now cleared that up. You asked the questions, and there is precedent before this court that on appeal, because the questions were asked, that we can amend the record. If we have to go back to the lower court to do that, if you order us to do that, we will. But we did not try to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. There is diversity.
Can you also address personal jurisdiction?
Personal jurisdiction is not something that the court ruled on. Clearly, it didn't rule in personal jurisdiction. Right. It's not in front of this court, but I will address it.
Jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is always in front of this court.
I will address it.
Okay.
I am a lawyer who's fairly well known in this city. I have supported the state of Israel for a very long time. I am known as a Zionist, for lack of a better word. I bring cases against terrorists. I brought cases even against Osama bin Laden. And consequently, to issue that kind of statement, which is intended to hurt me and my community, that is projecting yourself.
You just said your community is Florida.
I have several communities. I'm a lawyer before the District of Columbia Bar, and I'm a lawyer in front of the Florida Bar. That's undisputed. I've been a lawyer.
The due process clause requires that Mr. Bailey have contacts with D.C.
Well, he did.
Not that you. And what were his contacts?
Because he projected those statements into D.C. knowing that this was where I practice law and it was to hurt me. And, Your Honor, there is. And, you know, we're not anti—
How did he project them? How does your complaint allege that he projected them since he was simply the source? He wasn't the author of the article.
It says specifically in paragraphs 1 through 9 that it was projected into the District of Columbia. It says that, Your Honor.
I know it says that.
I can read it.
I'm trying to get a plausible factual allegation as to how a source has control over where something is published, whether or where something
is
published.
Mr. Bailey is a highly intelligent man. We never got a chance to go to discovery, Your Honor. We should have had discovery here. Okay? It was cut short.
Only for personal jurisdiction.
Let me be clear here, okay? This case was dismissed on the grounds of the anti-SLAPP statute, excuse me. It's a tongue twister. No other grounds. Discovery is automatically stayed once a motion is filed. We never had an opportunity to take discovery into his motivation and what he was trying to do, although it's clear on its face, and we did plead it in the complaint. And, Your Honor, if you would like, I can go back and read it on rebuttal. I'll find the specific provisions for
you. How do you distinguish our McFarland decision, McFarland versus Esquire magazine, for purposes of personal jurisdiction? Because I think that's your biggest hurdle. I know what your papers say.
I distinguish it on the facts of this case, which we weren't allowed to develop because this case was cut short under the anti-SLAPP statute, is that Mr. Bailey knows full well that this is my community, and so does the imam. The imam, by the way, who is a member of the Islamic Society of North America.
The imam was never served, so it wasn't before.
Whether or not, all kinds of issues, Your Honor, that you're raising were not in front of this judge. You know, if Your Honor is inclined to dismiss the case, you can find some reason to do it, but it's not in front of this court. And the reality here is that this case should have continued on. We should have been allowed to develop the facts here. It was cut short because it was dismissed on the grounds of only the anti-SLAPP statute. And that statute is a violation, this court has ruled, of Rules 12 and 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure because they allow cases to go to fact-finding and in front of a jury. And consequently, the issue of the statute of limitations did not arise. But if it did, we filed a lawsuit in federal court before the case at D.C. was dismissed voluntarily. There are no specific cases on point on this.
What day did you file that lawsuit? October 12th, is that right? October 12th is the day you filed the lawsuit.
Right, we got within the 1 year, which we didn't need to do.
The article was published October 11th.
And we're not basing this. No, we filed it. We made it by a day. Okay, if you go back and look at the dates.
Okay.
We made it by a day. But we didn't base this case solely on the publication. The complaint says clearly that they sent this, in effect, fatwa out into the Muslim world. You know, just today, turn on the news, the individual who killed Osama bin Laden, a Muslim woman, published on the Internet his address. And the poor guy, I mean, he's a Navy SEAL. He's scared to death, you can see, because there is this real risk. And they knew what they were doing. And to say that we are Nazis, to say that we are bigots against Islam, that we brought this case just to harass Muslims, which is not true. I've defended Muslims in cases. That is tantamount to telling the world, harm or kill Mr. Forrest and Mr. Klayman. That's the way the world works. That's a reality. That's not fiction. I sat in my office at Judicial Watch and watched the Pentagon go up in flames on 9/11. This imam told the world that the United States deserved what it got for 9/11. This is not some imam that's neutral. This is a guy who's a member of the Islamic Society of North America that was indicted co-conspirator in a federal court in Texas. So this is very serious, Your Honor. It's not an insult like the lower court judge said. In fact, her saying that insulted me.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher Hogue on behalf of Mr. Bailey. There is no subject matter jurisdiction in this case. It's very clear, not only from the lack of specificity in the submission that was made last evening, but also in an admission that Mr. Klayman made at pages 11 to 12 of his opposition to motion to dismiss, which we attached as Exhibit 1 to the opposition to the motion.
Well, that was an admission about residency, which is not the same as either domicile or citizenship.
Well, you know, he admits that there is a lack of diversity, is what he says. At the bottom of, the top of page 12, it says, moreover, I'm on the second line of page 12 of Exhibit 1, moreover, while Forrest was located in New York as well as Connecticut at the time of the initial complaint, this is no longer true, and therefore diversity of jurisdiction is properly invoked. And the citation is to the Caterpillar versus Lewis. That appears to be the concession that there was not diversity of citizenship until sometime later after the complaint had been filed. However, Caterpillar does not give the relief Mr. Klayman would like. Indeed, Caterpillar only applies where there is a diversity-destroying party who's dismissed out of the case. The correctly controlling case is a Supreme Court case called Grupo Dataflux, which I cited at page 3 of the opposition we filed last night. Once there is a failure to have diversity at the institution of the lawsuit, that is a failure that essentially continues and deprives the court of subject matter jurisdiction. Also, Judge Millett, you're absolutely correct. There is no in personam jurisdiction. The McFarland case is exactly on point, and there is no distinction that anybody has been able to draw to that. Mr. Bailey, this is the height of absurdity, very frankly. A lawyer makes a statement in litigation in New York. That statement is picked up by a national journal, a national newspaper. That paper happens to be published and sold, published in New York, but sold in a number of jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia. Somehow that is sufficient under international shoe to give this court in personam jurisdiction over Mr. Bailey. Granted, that was not something that the court below relied upon. The court below felt that both the anti-SLAPP provision as well as the statute of limitations issue allowed dismissal and never addressed the question of personal.
I'm sorry, the statute of limitations, is my math right or wrong that the article was October 11th from the 2011 and the lawsuit was October 12th, 2012?
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe that the statement was made on October the 8th mm-hmm. in court, and it was published in the Post on October 11th. Of course, Mr. Bailey had nothing to do with that. And the lawsuit in the D.C. Superior Court under a one-year statute of limitations was October the 12th. Mm-hmm. So it was either 4 days late or 1 day late, but either way, it was late. And then obviously, after it was voluntarily dismissed without prejudice, by the way, after three failures to file an opposition to a motion to dismiss or a motion for judgment on the pleadings, rather, in the Superior Court case, that case was dismissed without prejudice and then rebrought the exact same case here in this court. There's no relation back in that court. The case that was filed in this court did not happen until 2012. So he's out of court on statute of limitations as well. also out of court on such fundamental principles as New York Times versus Sullivan, litigation privilege, many, many different.
I was curious, in a diversity suit in D.C., and I take it looks like it may not be an issue, judicial privilege may be about the same in the two jurisdictions, but does a judicial privilege, in a diversity case, does a judicial privilege that applied in the forum where the statement was made in court, i.e. New York, govern, or because you're litigating in D.C., is it the D.C. judicial privilege that
would cover? I think it's substantive law, so I think that the law of the place of the alleged tort is the law that would govern, is the way I would analyze it.
And so D.C. law is what you say would govern?
Yes, that's right.
Mr. Hogue, what's your best authority? I see that in the relation back analysis, the district court cites district court cases. Do you have any stronger authority for the notion that assuming the D.C. case was timely filed, that subsequently filed same complaint in the federal court would not relate back?
I don't believe there are any cases that we've found that address that point specifically, and I don't think anything has been cited by either side on that. I think it's a fundamental principle that when a case is dismissed without prejudice by the party who brought it, that there's nothing that would in some way toll the operation of the statute until the later filing in the U.S. District Court. So I can't answer the court with any direct case law authority, but it seems to me almost intuitive, if not fundamental, that there would be no such relation back.
Although if a case is removed by a defendant from a state court or from the superior court to the federal court, then it would carry over.
Well, I would agree
over.
With that, but this was certainly not a removal. This was a cynical, very frankly, the precipice that was filed of dismissal, first of all, was done in violation of the superior court rules because at that stage in the litigation, it needed to be done with the consent of both parties, and that didn't happen. But second of all, there was a statement, an overt statement by Mr. Klayman in the dismissal that the reason that he was dismissing it in the District of Columbia Superior Court in face of a pretty extensive motion for judgment on the pleadings, including anti-SLAPP statute relief, was that he wanted to take advantage of a trial court decision in the federal court case, the Bolter decision, which was subsequently upheld by Alves, essentially. So I don't think it's analogous to a removal. I think it was a multiple litigation, cynical decision that this was a way to avoid the obvious trap that he was walking into with the Anti-SLAPP Act in the District of Columbia.
Well, I think without imputing or finding bad faith, we would have to come up with a rule how to treat that kind of situation where essentially the same case, same parties, same allegations is moved based on a perception that there might be federal court jurisdiction, whether there's a relation back there.
Well, what I would suggest is that it's a burden on the plaintiff to show that there is a relation back. And I don't see any demonstration or even contention by Mr. Klayman that there is a relation back.
It doesn't help to relate back if the first action would have been time barred anyhow.
Well, that's the point we were just discussing. If it was too late in Superior Court, it doesn't matter if it relates back, and it was too late in Superior Court. I want to say just a word, if I might have a couple of minutes, to talk about attorney's fees. We understand the Abbas decision. We have issues with the Abbas decision. We think it conflicts with a number of other circuits, but we understand that we're bound by that law. What we're not bound, however, is by footnote 6 of the Abbas decision, which talks about the unavailability of attorney's fees in the event you can't get anti-SLAPP relief in the federal court because it's a diversity case. That footnote is dicta. I'm sorry, and I misspoke. It's footnote 5. There are two cases, Aliesha and Napera, cited at page 54 of our brief, which say that in this type of a situation, indeed, attorney's fees are available, and indeed, even if the court finds that it does not have subject matter jurisdiction over this litigation, attorney's fees are allowed under those two cases, Aliesha and Napera. This is a case that cries out for an award of sanctions. Judge Rothstein certainly thought so. This is the definition of multiple and vexatious litigation. It just cries out for...
None of that's before us. I mean, the district court clearly reserved that issue.
That's true. That's true. I'm simply saying that, well, I think it is before you as to whether or not the court has the authority to award attorney's fees. Judge Rothstein.
The district court hasn't exercised any discretion yet, hasn't made any decision on that. I don't know
except
how
to
we
say
have that,
that
ripe issue before us.
Well, the judge did say that we were entitled to attorney's fees, just that there had to be a hearing in terms
of
determining.
In an opinion, the world has changed a bit from when she wrote that opinion.
Right. Well, I understand that. Mm-hmm. I understand that. And I have nothing further to say. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Klayman, we'll give you just 2 minutes.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Your Honor. The statements that were made by Mr. Hoog are not accurate. We alleged in the complaint that the matter was published in the New York Post on October 12, 2010. For purposes of a motion to dismiss, given there's no discovery, you have to accept what we said in the complaint is true. So that was a misrepresentation by Mr. Hoog, and I hope that it'll be corrected. Secondly, with regard to the issues of this case, I mean, you can talk about anything you want, but the reality is the judge dismissed solely on the basis of the anti-SLAPP statute. And we didn't hinge just our allegations on defamation or false light. We also said in the complaint, in paragraph 8, that these statements that I'm an enemy of Islam, in effect, because we hate Muslims and despise the religion, and we're the equivalent of the Third Reich and Nazis, that created intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's the primary claim. And there's a 3-year statute of limitations on that. And Your Honor can look at the case Saunders versus Nemati, 580 A. 2nd, 660 D.C. 1990, which cites a case.
Is that in your brief?
I'm sorry?
Is that case in your brief?
No, that case is not in our brief. I found it yesterday.
Did you tell the other side that you were going to refer to this case at oral argument?
I found it late last night, Your Honor.
Well, you did a lot of filings late last night, so you could have emailed them and let them know about the case.
My colleagues found it and sent it to me this morning. Saunders versus Nemati, 580 A. 2nd, 660 D.C. 1990. Similar case cited where victims of Palestinian terrorists in Israel, by the way, brought a case in federal court here and in D.C. Superior Court here. And they were threatened. I mean, the assault that applied and the intentional infliction of emotional distress were considered separate. So we deserve an opportunity to go back to lower court and make these arguments, because all the court considered, she talked about a melange of issues, but then she said, I'm only deciding the SLAPP. And this court has decided the SLAPP correctly. Thank God you have done that. I commend all of you for knocking out the SLAPP statute, which is also unconstitutional.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Klayman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted.